This is On Location. I'm Tim Leitner. Today's program comes to you from Saratoga, New York, Crozet, Virginia, and Anchorage, Alaska. But first, On Location is produced by the NCA Communications Committee with special production assistance from Joe Manlin and me. You can find our podcast on iTunes, Anchor, Spotify, Google Podcast, Breaker, iHeartRadio, and Radio Public, among others. So subscribe today on your favorite podcast service and tell all your friends. On this episode of On Location, Tim Leitner with CGI and Mary Ellen Keeley, the Grants and Initiatives Consultant Senior for the Virginia Child Support Program, continue the conversation with Rob Velkoff with Intergovernmental Support Services. Rob discusses some more of the hot topics in intergovernmental casework and the challenges they include, such as case closure regulations, interest charges, and income withholding orders on unemployment insurance benefits. Check out Rob's recent article in the January 2023 issue of the NCA Child Support Communique, better known as the CSQ, titled Intergovernmental Hot Topics, Part 2. It's going to be a great show, so stick around, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to another episode of NCIA On Location, coming to you from New York, Virginia, and Alaska. Today, we're pleased to have a guest that is well known to the child support community and this podcast, Rob Velkoff, to talk about his second installment of the Intergovernmental Hot Topics. I'm Mary Ellen Keeley with Virginia Child Support in Crozet, Virginia, and let me first introduce my co-host today, Tim Leitner with CGI. Tim?
Thank you, Mary Ellen. I'm Tim Leitner, and it's great to be back on the podcast with you and Rob. As you mentioned, I'm a senior business consultant with CGI Technologies and Solutions coming to you from Anchorage, Alaska. And so today, Rob, let's have you reintroduce yourself and remind our all-time listeners and our new listeners who you are. Maybe a little bit about yourself, what roles you've held in child support, what interested you. Just give us the big picture.
Okay, thanks, Tim and Mary Ellen. Hi, for those who don't know me, I'm Rob Velkoff. Originally from New York State Office of Child Support Services. I worked there for over 30 years, a lot less gray hair when I started there. And now I have my own agency, Intergovernmental Support Services, where I do anything and everything related to intergovernmental child support, interstate training, international, tribal, special grants, projects, things of that nature. As far as things about me, originally from the Coney Island area of Brooklyn, we are taping this just after 4th of July. I know it's not going to be played for a while, but we just had the hot dog eating contest there. I did not take part in that. I live up in upstate New York now. Those familiar with upstate New York, I'm in the Saratoga area, north of Albany. Typical day, wow. Let's see, lots of meetings. My email looks like a checkerboard as far my calendar as far as different meetings goes. Lots of emails, working on different projects and grants. I do a lot of volunteer work for NCIA, as well as ERICSA and other organizations. We'll be talking about that a little bit later on, as well as some other volunteer work for not-for-profits. Spending days with, I live with my son, a young adult. My daughter is close by in her own place, so I spend a lot of time with them, trying to keep out of trouble.
So, Rob, has anything changed since the last time we spoke to you about your work?
I've been doing a lot more training in different states. Let's see, recently I was in California and Louisiana, Indianapolis, Indiana, New Jersey. I'm going to be in Pennsylvania in another month or so. I do a lot of virtual online training for different agencies, all related to intergovernmental. Created a brand new session called Intermediate Intergovernmental, which falls in between the basics and the advanced. Going to be doing that at WCSIC. And I've done that at a couple of state conferences. So that's occupied a lot of my time lately, and I enjoy training. I enjoy teaching child support workers how to deal with intergovernmental child support cases. They're traditionally a more difficult case to work with, doing some things with international, and those are even harder to work on than our intergovernmental, than our interstate, than our regular, more local cases. So those different trainings, I'm creating some new courses too, all the intergovernmental. So hopefully people will be seeing those in the months and years ahead.
Excellent. Thank you. And for our listeners, don't worry if you didn't write it down. We're going to ask Rob again at the end of the podcast to talk about what kind of trainings are coming. So we're really excited to have you here again today, Rob. And we really appreciate the information that you provide to the child support community, both in written articles and presentations and continuing to be guests on our podcast. Actually, your last visit with us was one of our most listened to NCIA podcasts. So we have to make this one really good so that everyone wants to listen to this one as much.
No pressure.
Right. None whatsoever. So today we're going to talk about the second article that you published in the January CSQ about intergovernmental hot topics. And for our listeners who like an agenda, like myself, those topics were case closure, interest, income withholding order, and unemployment benefits.
So, Rob, you started off writing about interstate case closure regulations. If you would, remind us of how many case closure criteria there are, and do they differ from whether you're in an issuing jurisdiction or the responding jurisdiction? And I bet there's some inconsistencies that have caught your attention.
Yes, there are currently 21 federal case closure criteria that are covered in the federal regs. Of those 21, and please remember that states, they're not mandatory. States can pick and choose which ones they want to adopt and which ones they do not want. Some states have all 21. I'm sure all states have some of those, but many states do not have all 21 of them, so they are not consistent across state lines. If they adopt one, they have to adopt it as is written. They can't change it. They can't change time frames or what have you. But they are free to not adopt a particular case closure criterion. Regarding responding jurisdictions on intergovernmental cases, the initiating jurisdiction is the state that starts the case, state or tribe or other jurisdiction, and the responding jurisdiction is the one that receives the case and works it on behalf of the initiating jurisdiction. The responding jurisdiction has only three of those 21 case closure criteria that apply directly to it, number 17, 18, and 19. The other, doing math in my head, the other 18 case closure criteria are at the discretion of the initiating jurisdiction. So if these two states or tribes or territories, a tribe and a state, whatever it is, happen to not agree on it's not that they don't agree, they don't have the same criteria in place. One jurisdiction may want to close a case, the other jurisdiction may want to keep the case open, the same exact situation. The three that the responding jurisdiction can use, I mentioned before, 17, 18, and 19, this is found in Code of Federal Regulations, Section 303.11, are the initiating jurisdiction fails to provide some information to the responding jurisdiction for them to continue the case. Number 18 is the initiating agency has notified the responding state that they're closing the case. And number 19, the initiating state has asked the responding state to close the case. So that is it. So basically, responding jurisdiction is at the discretion of the initiating jurisdiction is when they can close their case and when they can keep it open. So in theory, the responding jurisdiction may want to close their case because of a certain one of the other 21 case closure criteria that are out there. But if there's initiating jurisdiction doesn't use that criteria, the responding jurisdiction can't close. I use it as an example. One of the case closure criteria, number 9, is that the non-custodial parent's sole income is from supplemental security income, SSI. Some states use that, some states don't. So if an initiating jurisdiction does not use that, but the responding jurisdiction does, the responding jurisdiction may want to close their case. They have a non-custodial parent. Only form of income is SSI, they're going to close. They may have just closed, two or three local cases, local meaning everything within that jurisdiction, for that exact reason. They may contact the initiating jurisdiction and say, hey, NCP's on SSI, we're going to close. The initiating jurisdiction who does not use that case closure criteria can say, no, you're not. We want you to keep that case open. We're not closing our case because that's not one of the case closure criteria that we use. And under those circumstances, the responding jurisdiction would have to keep the case open. Sort of flies in the face of logic here. They're not going to be able to do much with that case. And that's just an example. It's any, it could apply to any of the other 18 case closure criteria that are out there. It just leads to inconsistency and some difficulty. NCIA sister organization, ERICSA, recently sent a letter to Federal Office of Child Support Services, OCSS, that's their new name, no longer OCSA. I got it right, score one for me, asking about this, saying, you know, why can't the responding jurisdiction use all 21 criteria? And the feds gave a very nice reply, very thought out and well written, basically saying that they want the initiating jurisdiction to maintain control of the case and that they need to have the authority to say to the responding jurisdiction either close or to keep it open. So they were not going to budge on, you know, on allowing the responding jurisdiction to use all 21 case closure criteria. So it does set up some difficulty, responding states keeping cases open that they would normally close, trying to get information from the initiating jurisdiction to assist with those cases. So it is something that I think does need an additional look at in the future to see, you know, trying to get some cooperation on these interstate cases where one state would normally close, the other state won't.
You know, Rob, I was just thinking as you were talking that that may put some contention or some ill feeling sometimes between states when one does do something and one says, no, you can't close. And it may not be the most smooth or the most warm and fuzzy feeling between those two caseworkers in two different states.
Yeah, caseworkers in responding jurisdictions need to understand that it's certainly nothing personal. It's that in the initiating jurisdiction, they don't close for that particular reason. So they're not going to let the RJ close either. And like it or not, with the way that the current regs are written, you have to keep those cases open. So communication, and anyone who's seen any of my interstate trainings over the years knows that I always say communication is the most important part in intergovernmental case processing. Talk to each other, find out what you guys can do, what you guys can't do, and cooperation, which is mandatory under USA, but cooperation is difficult to enforce. How do you force a state to cooperate with another state? I do think we all try to help each other. The intent is good. The application thereof, not always, but you know, please communicate with each other and try to come up with a compromise if need be.
That communication skill set is definitely one that I have carried from my days as an intergovernmental caseworker into my policy and now into my grant management role for sure. So I was really interested in the section about interest after my experience as an intergovernmental caseworker in a state that charges interest. So especially that concept of forgiveness. So I had two questions and you can kind of address them in whichever order you prefer. So my first thought was, you know, what are your tips for intergovernmental caseworkers when it comes to interest? And then secondly, when we think about big picture, any advice for leadership or policy consultants as they're deciding on policies surrounding interest forgiveness?
I want to start off by saying that please remember that interest is not just a child support thing. Many states charge interest on all money judgments, whether it's a child support judgment or whether it's not a child support judgment. So the child support community does not have the authority at certain times to just say, we're going to stop charging interest by snapping your fingers. It's more complicated than that. It's further reaching than that. About two-thirds of the states and jurisdictions do charge some form of interest. The majority, it's a flat amount, 10%, 8%, 6%, et cetera. Others, it changes throughout the year, too, based on some different market values. Others, it changes from year to year based on federal rates. So and it is a complicated issue. If you do additional research, you see that certain states charge a different interest amount on arrears that accrued further back in time and that have changed their interest rate, but it's not retroactive. So that can even complicate things further. And also remember that one state should never expect another state to charge its interest rate. Enforce, yes, charge, no. One state system will not be able to calculate a different interest rate than whatever that state charges. States that don't charge interest at all still have to enforce interest on behalf of another state. You can't just say, well, we don't charge interest on our arrears, so we're not going to enforce your interest. Not allowed. That is bad. And states that don't charge interest often have a lesser desire to enforce interest. They don't think it's needed. I mean, we could debate interest in child support, whether it's good or bad. I mean, some custodial parents need the interest money that is due. You know, And remember, you're not charging interest if all payments are made. It's only on delinquent payments. And if a non-custodial parent is delinquent in their payments, a custodial parent may be delinquent in paying some of her or his bills, and there may be interest charged on that end. So the interest helps there. People that don't like charging interest state that, you know, non-custodial parents have enough trouble meeting their current obligations, maybe a little bit towards arrears, and now you're charging more and more arrears. Interest on arrears, the arrears are going to be higher and higher, and they can't even afford to pay current, let alone additional amounts. You know, we want right-size orders, and interest is making it harder. And we've seen some maybe arrears-only cases that are charging interest, and the NCP is making some payments, but the actual payments that he or she are making are smaller than the interest being charged. So, you know, the arrears can be $10,000, make a payment of $250 a month, but with the interest accruing, the arrears are actually more after the month ends than they were before. In that scenario, an NCP will never pay off the arrears, not with just the regular monthly payments. There's federal tax offset and other ways of getting arrears monies, as we all know. But so interest is a very controversial topic. And when it's in state, on what I call a local case, both parties within the same jurisdiction, state or tribe, that's one thing, and states usually have a handle on that. If they don't charge interest, they don't. If they do, they know how much to charge, and it's charged at on their system. But when you get a second jurisdiction involved, a second state, that are probably going to have a different arrears amount, if any, then it becomes even more complicated because the responding jurisdiction cannot calculate the interest that the initiating jurisdiction charges. Some states will charge interest on a single missed payment. Other states will charge interest only on money judgments that went into court for an arrears judgment. So even that's more complicated. Again, no one expects the responding jurisdiction to charge the interest rate. You'll have to contact the initiating jurisdiction and say, what are the arrears? How often do you do this? There's nothing in federal regulations that says how often you have to reconcile the arrears. Quarterly, annually, I like quarterly if you're able to. If you have a larger caseload, annually may be the best that you can do. Certainly, if the case is going into court for any reason, for a modification hearing or for an enforcement hearing, you're going to want to have the most accurate arrears triggers at that time. It becomes even more complicated when we may be familiar with when there's a third state involved, like there's a court order state and both parties are in different states, and that court order state is keeping the arrears record but not seeing payments go through it. And that arrears record will include interest. The other two states that are actually working the case, one with the CP, one with the NCP, they may not charge interest or not that interest rate. You've got a third state's interest rate involved. And sometimes that initiating, the court order state will close their case, which means that they're not charging interest on their system. You know, the other two states will have to figure out, do you charge the interest at all? Now you do have to somehow calculate what the interests are. Most states will just not charge interest at that point. So it's a very complicated issue. There's been a call to stop charging interest only on interstate cases. I respectfully disagree with that. If for the initiating jurisdiction, they're charging their interest rate. If the responding jurisdiction was going to not enforce it, the IJ is still calculating it. So the NCP will have an even higher amount of arrears owed because the interest is still accruing and charging. Unless the initiating jurisdiction stops it, that's kind of a mess. I understand in theory, it's very complicated. Why are we doing this on an interstate case with two or three or more states involved? But unless you're going to just stop the interest altogether, you can't have one state not charging, but the other state accruing more and more and more, so that if the case is no longer interstate, wham, the NCP owes all kinds of money. And then, you know, the CPs may not want to just stop the interest. I know interest is often used for arrears forgiveness. That's an important tool there. Some states require the CP to agree. Other states will do it themselves, which I've always thought was a little strange. But anyway, it is a very complicated issue. There is no easy answer. I think the best way unless we see of change from federal OCSS or that all the states agree on, you know, let the initiating jurisdiction, the court order state, calculate the arrears, report periodically to the responding jurisdiction what the arrears actually are. And the responding jurisdiction changes their system, the arrears do, based on the payment records of the IJ, like they do, you know, on a non-interest-bearing account if the arrears are different. So, you know, that might kumbaya speech again, working together, communications, there's that C word again. And just making sure that I think constant communications, depending on your definition of the word constant, feel free to contact each other every quarter, every year, every 6 months, whatever it is, to make sure that those arrears are correct. No one wants more arrears taken than are actually due. Again, if other people who have a better answer, feel free to contact me and we can discuss it. But it's just one of those not easy answer scenarios. Interest.
Yeah, sounds. I think you're right. Sounds a little bit messy and about as clear as mud. At some points. And from my interstate days as well, interstate days as well, trying to reconcile and figure out who's got the right amount and telling the paying parent that, no, you still owe. And he says, no, the other state shows I'm paid up. It gets real contentious at times.
Remember, the initiating jurisdiction submits for federal tax offset. The spawning jurisdiction does pretty much everything else. And so their spawning jurisdiction, as you said, Tim, may have the case paid in full on their record, so they don't take the IRS offset. The NCP thinks he or she is paid in full, and all of a sudden their taxes get taken because, lo and behold, you're not paid in full. So interstate reconciliation of arrears is difficult enough even without interest. When you add in the interest, it becomes a much more difficult thing. I think one of the things is, and the perfectionists out there are going to yell and scream at me and hit me with objects, don't try to be perfect on these. Try to get your arrears as close as you can, as close as is accurate. If it's a few dollars, transport program nationwide is about the dollars, not about the cents, I've always felt. And if you're in the ballpark of what the arrears should be, you can reconcile to get an exact amount at a future time. Enforce the majority of the interest, including your arrears, as best as you can. And, you can get the exact dollar amount for a little further on down the line.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Rob, let's talk about interstate income withholding orders, or IWOs, on unemployment insurance benefits. Can you share a little bit about the history of the income withholding order and the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act of 1996? Boy, that's a little ways back. And I've got some follow-up questions, but let's just start there.
Okay, yeah, I'm dating myself a little bit here. Yes, I was in the child support program back in the 80s. Okay, I'm kind of depressed now. The way that it worked, people who have been around almost as long as I have remember in days of old when there was an interstate case, the two parties in two different states, before UIFSA was enacted, you could not send an income withholding order to another state. You had to do the whole registration process and get that second state involved. And we know, back then there wasn't as much movement around the country as there is today, but there was still plenty, especially by some NCPs who would move from state to state. And every time I'd send a new whole USA packet to another state. One of the best things, I think, in my personal opinion, the best thing about UFSA, and there's other great things too. Telephonic testimony is terrific. There's a lot of excellent things in UFSA, but one of the best things is the Interstate Income Withholding Order, IWO, where a transport agency in one state can send an income withholding order to an employer in any state in the United States, and it has to be honored. I'll repeat, any state. Tribal child support does not have, tribal agencies do not have UIFSA. International, other countries do not have UIFSA, so they are not bound by it. Tribes in the U.S. have federal legislation, such as the Federal Full Faith and Credit for Child Support Orders Act, FCSOA, meaning they have to give full faith and credit to an order of another state. But our tribes don't have UIFSA. They are not bound. Do not send, unless the tribe says so, don't send an income withholding order to a tribal employer. Getting back to the main point. Now we can send those IWOs, and that's a tremendous savings of time and effort and energy and not getting a second state involved. So interstate IWO is one of the most important tools that exists for in child support. And keep in mind that in days of old, it was up to 3/4 of payments. Since the pandemic and new gig economy and contractor IWOs are currently between 62 and 65% of all payments. So down from the 3/4, but still 2/3 almost of our payments are coming in via IWO on child support cases. And on interstate cases, it's similar. It's not, you don't even create an interstate case. It's still considered a local case. So that's how IWO started on interstate cases with UIFSA 1996, Section 501 of UIFSA. Employer's receipt of income withholding order of another state, basically they have to treat it as if it was issued by their own state. Now, that's income. What is income? And that varies from state to state, from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, from person to person who you ask. Not all states consider unemployment insurance as income, and that's where the problem starts on this. Only 14 states in the country currently accept IWOs from other state agencies on unemployment insurance. The other, help me out, 54 states and territories, about 40 don't. They require registration of the order, which is, again, what UFSA, one of the main things it was supposed to stop is these opening of interstate cases just to issue an IWO. Reasons for that, again, vary. Sometimes it's just that state's definition of income does not include unemployment insurance, and as such, it's not appropriate to send an IWO. Most states have a mass match with their unemployment insurance office, meaning it's not just an individual IWO in every case. It's some type of system-to-system match between the Child Support Office and the unemployment insurance agency that they, you know, all cases are sent simultaneously, and the unemployment insurance office works on all cases. Some I've heard from talking to back when I was with New York, our own unemployment insurance office, saying they could not handle individual income withholding orders. To me, that's not an answer. If employers can do it, unemployment insurance agencies can do it as well. They may have to take some time to change their systems. I get that. I'm not saying just snap your fingers and do it, but that, you know, that's not a reason not to do it if that state would say, yes, this is now considered income. And the states that do accept income withholding orders on their unemployment insurance from other states are Georgia, Indiana, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, New Jersey, New York, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, and Wisconsin. NCA's sister organization, ERICSA, has a chart and information about how to issue an income withholding order to an unemployment insurance office in another state. Look on their intergovernmental tools section. Federal OCSS on the IRG, Intergovernmental Reference Guide, has that information as well. You can look up an individual state to see how it works. If you're not one of those states that I just mentioned, so 14 out of 54, it's just a little over one quarter. So the, you know, almost three quarters of states and jurisdictions do not honor income withholding order for UIB. If you're not one of those states or territories, please consider it. Saves you a lot of work because on all your incoming cases, you're not having to register all those orders and send out, you know, these additional cases. So saves time and energy. And more importantly, it gets money in the hands of the children and families that we're serving much quicker, much higher percentage of the time. So that's really the most important method of reason around this. So please consider changing your definition of income to include unemployment insurance. What that would entail from jurisdiction to jurisdiction and state to state is going to vary. Do you require a legislative change? Is it a policy decision, something like that? You'll have to decide. But other than because it's the law, that's the only reason why I can see to not do this. And if it's the law, it can be changed. Contact one of those states I just said and asking, how is it working? And they may not be able to answer because they're not involved in it. They don't see any work on these unemployment insurance IWOs because it's bypassing them altogether. I'm sure the child support agencies across the country would be very happy not to do extra work. We are all overworked. We all have way too many cases that we are handling. I talked to some child support workers with four-digit caseloads over 1,000, which is crazy, but that's the reality in certain states. Is it Rhode Island, I think, has 2,000 cases per worker? I was talking to their 40 directors. So you get some staggering numbers and less work, especially on something that can be done by someone else, either quicker, faster, better, cheaper, is the way to go. So please look at your definition of income. And is that the only thing standing in the way of allowing other states to send income withholding orders? If they can do it for employment, why can't they do it for unemployment? Same concept. Just it's a different thing. So I know states are thinking of adding income withholding orders to independent contractors and gig economy work and things like that. So we're trying to expand the use of IWO. Unemployment would be, and again, unemployment is limited. So by the time that sometimes that, you know, the registration process can take months, and a good chunk of the unemployment insurance that an NCU is going to get are gone by then. If they can just send out an IWO directly to that state, it would save a lot of time. You get a lot more money again. So something that can be handled a lot simpler than interest, which is the previous conversation, is this topic, IWO on UIB, unemployment insurance benefits. I call for states to examine their policies and practices and legislation and see if they can expand that number from 14 states to 54, or at least as close as we can, in the near future.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you would think that if the local child support office can send a withholding order to unemployment and unemployment honors that, then why wouldn't an out-of-state IWO have the same effect?
Absolutely.
Rob, I think we could probably sit here all day and talk about ways to improve caseworkers' lives in the office. But I also know that our podcast listeners may like us to start looking towards the end of this. So I'm going to go back to what we talked about at the beginning, and that was about training opportunities. So what training opportunities are out there for intergovernmental staff? And then I have a follow-up to that, but I'll let you start there.
Okay, many and varied. First of all, pretty much all states have some type of intergovernmental training available to them. Many states contract to private colleges or other training institutions. Other jurisdictions just have transport workers who do training themselves to other staff. So if you're a county worker or a regional office worker, look to your state office to see what kind of intergovernmental training they may offer. There's also larger training on the national level. Federal Office of Child Support Services, OCSS, on their OCSS website has interstate and international training opportunities. They often, they sometimes do training as well. There's the national organizations, NCIA, who's sponsoring this podcast, as well as some of our sister organizations, Eastern Regional Interstate Child Support Association, or ICSA, WICSEC, the Western Intergovernmental Child Support Engagement Council, NTCSA, National Tribal Child Support Association, and others that offer training as well. In July is the Tribal Conference. In August, we have the NCIA Leadership Symposium. Coming up in the fall is WICSEC. All of these, you can contact me about any intergovernmental training. Shoot me an email, give me a call. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have about that. So the training is out there. There's a lot of topics. There's beginner, there's intermediate, there's advanced, there's international, there's modifications, there's one state, interstate, there's a myriad of trainings available. And, you know, different courses and different methods. Some are face-to-face, some are virtual. Almost all of them are very, very good. So if you have any questions about that, shoot me an email or give me a call. But look for these other agencies, your own state agency and these other national agencies that do training. Conferences are coming up. Again, some are in person, some are offer virtual options. They're all worth your time. If you're an intergovernmental worker, training is vital, I think. It's impossible to know. I mean, I've been at this for over 30 years, and even I'm learning things still. So for your newer workers who are processing cases, for your attorneys, your court personnel, the training is available out there. Just a matter of getting your hands on it.
Excellent. And there's also some IJ fairs coming up this fall. Is that right?
Right. There's one. We just had one. The three jurisdictions, WICSEC, ARICSA, and NTCSA Tribal, are cooperating on these IJ fairs that have different jurisdictions, states, and tribes talking about different things in their states. They are free, the big four-letter word, F-R-E-E, to everyone who are in the child support community. I know ARICSA has a special intergovernmental training event day, September 29th, an entire day of training for intergovernmental staff. NCIA has Intergovernmental Connects. It is a bi-monthly call that I chair, and we talk about a different topic every other month for 1 hour, and you hear about how jurisdictions do different facets of an interstate case. ARICSA has an intergovernmental improvement committee that if you're a member of ARICSA, you went to their conference or pay an annual fee. It's a monthly call about different what's new in intergovernmental. These are all virtual, so you don't have to actually go anywhere other than to your computer. So between the IJ fairs, the webinars that NCIA has, ARICSA has webinars, training, they are out there. And I know conferences can be expensive. Out-of-state travel is always hard, but a lot of these are virtual too. NCIA has one or two webinars every month, and some of those are intergovernmental. And we've got a few international ones coming up in the coming months for the webinars that NCIA is holding. So please look at the NCIA website to find out information about those webinars and those other organizations as well, what is being offered.
So Rob, you've been involved not only with the Child Support Program for quite a while, but also focused on interstate and intergovernmental processes, which you're obviously very passionate about, have a wealth of information. So let's ask you this question. What inspires you, whether it be about child support, interstate, or anything else?
And you're right, Tim. I work, my area of expertise may be interstate, but I'm involved with a lot of different areas of child support. All different areas now, especially since I've entered my own agency into the realm of governmental support services. But interstate cases are harder than local cases are. Parties, there's, you know, different state laws. UIFSA, first word of UIFSA is uniform. We all know that that uniform is a term, but all states have different laws and rules and regulations. I really worked very hard, and I'm passionate about cooperation between states and other jurisdictions in working these cases. I think everyone wants to help each other. You know, we've heard horror stories. Oh, I can never get a hold of anyone. Why is this other state messing up my case or whatever? I think people try to do the right thing, and I help to facilitate that. I do have a life outside of child support, limited though it may be. You know, I volunteer a lot of time for NC. I volunteer a lot of time for RCSA. People who know me know I volunteer a lot of time for the regional food bank of Northeastern New York State. I both work for them as an employee, and I volunteer a lot of time for them. I'm the annoying guy during the winter holidays at the booth at the mall who goes up and begs people for money for the food bank. Actually, I do more. A lot of high school and college kids will volunteer for that, and some community service people. I do more bossing of them around than I do of begging for money myself. But if you're in the Saratoga, Albany area in the winter holidays, you'll hear my voice shouting out about donating money at one of the local malls. So I spend a lot, and I volunteer for that organization in, throughout the year as well. People who listened to the first podcast may remember that I challenged people then. I'm going to do that now. Volunteer is a very important thing. There's a lot of excellent not-for-profits out there. NC is one. RCSA, WICSEC, Tribal Support are other ones. So there's the children ones. And then there's, you know, a myriad of other ones in your areas. And I know our time is limited. We're putting in 40, 50, 60 hours a week on a regular job. We have families. I've got kids. My son is in the next room, probably cleaning out my refrigerator. My daughter lives about 15 minutes away from me. I see her as often as I can. So we have our own families, our own lives, our own passions. But, you know, remember to donate your time if you can. Donate whatever you're able to these charities, these not-for-profits. I think it goes hand-in-hand with what we do, helping children and families on our day job. Try to find whatever limited time you have to assist some of these agencies in your private time as well.
So besides the last words or thoughts you just shared with us about your passions and about child support, just a couple of questions here. You mentioned that if people have questions about intergovernmental, interstate, interjurisdictional trainings coming up, that they can contact you. Would you mind giving your email address or how to get a hold of you?
It's all over the web, my email address. It is ridiculously long. When I opened up my own agency, it was the only choice that I had. Rob Velkoff, one word, at intergovernmentalsupportservices.com. intergovernmentalsupportservices.com. Feel free to shoot me an email. Again, my email is on the NC website, on the RCSA website. It's all over the place too. I think if you just do a Google search for Rob Velkoff, I'm pretty sure I'm the only one on the planet. I may have a cousin somewhere that I don't know of. Yeah, feel free to shoot me an email. Again, I'd start first with your state offices to see what they have available. But then if there's something additional, you want a more, you know, something else above and beyond that, look to the organizations, NCIA, WICSEC, RCSA, NTCSA, NCCSD, the Child Support Directors. They don't do training, but they have intergovernmental work groups and things. So look to those organizations. If you have any questions, feel free to shoot me an email, 518-852-9469. I'm in a lot of meetings. Email's a lot better, but I'll throw out my phone number there. And happy to try to help anyone that needs any information about training and intergovernmental child support.
Awesome. You know, Rob, one thing that's always impressed me about you is that you're always willing to help, always willing to be a resource and available to people. So thank you so much for doing that.
My pleasure.
And I did want to call out, if anyone wants to hear your first podcast on intergovernmental hot topics, that's dated January 26th of 2022. So that's a very nice companion piece with this and to kind of get the bigger picture of intergovernmental hot topics.
The NCIA Communique has those two articles in them going back this year and again a couple years ago. So feel free to look those up then.
Excellent. Well, Rob, we want to thank you for joining us today for another episode of NCIA On Location to speak to us about intergovernmental hot topics. We want to thank you for all that you've done and continue to do for the Child Support Program, as well as what you do for NCIA. I want to encourage our listeners to check out Rob's articles in the CSQ. He mentioned one of them. And then there's the one that we're specifically talking about today, January 2023 release. Thank you to our listeners for joining us today. And on behalf of Tim Leitner and myself, I'm Mary Ellen Keeley, and this has been NCIA On Location.
On Location is available on iTunes, Anchor, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and anywhere you get your podcasts. We have a lot of great episodes on the way, so be sure to subscribe and listen to all of our previous episodes as well. We also appreciate your ratings, your feedback, your comments, and your suggestions. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, please reach out to us on the contact link on our website. On Location is a production of the NCIA Communications Committee with special production assistance from Joe Mamlin and me. Thanks again for joining me. I'm Tim Leitner, and this has been On Location.